but I can't relax. Not really. Until the clock inches past midnight, and the phone Nate gave me rings. He's called me every night since Monday, always around the same time. He's told me things I couldn't have imagined about his mother's illness and his father's drinking. I've told him about Maeve's cancer and the nameless pressure I've always felt to be twice as good at everything. Sometimes we don't talk at all. Last night he suggested we watch a movie, and we both logged into Netflix and watched a god-awful horror movie he picked until 2 in the morning. I fell asleep with my earbud still in, and might have snored in his ear at some point.
"Your turn to pick a movie,"
he says by way of greeting. I've noticed that about Nate. He doesn't do pleasantries, just starts with whatever's on his mind. My mind's elsewhere, though. "I'm looking," I say, and we're silent for a minute as I scroll through Netflix titles without really seeing them. It's no good. I can't go straight into movie mode. "Nate, are you in trouble because of how everything came out at school today?" After I left Principal Gupta's office, the rest of the afternoon was a blur of stares, whispers, and uncomfortable conversations with Kate and Yumiko, once I finally explained what had been going on for the past few days. He snorts a short laugh.
"I was in trouble before. Nothing's changed."
"My friends are mad at me for not telling them."
"About cheating? Or being investigated by the police?"
"Both. I hadn't said anything about either. I thought maybe it would all go away, and they'd never have to know." Robin had said not to answer any questions about the case, but I didn't see how I could apply that to my two best friends. "When the whole school's starting to turn against you, you need somebody on your side." I wish I could remember more about that day. What class were you in when Mr. Avery found the phone in your backpack?
"Physical science,"
Nate says.
"Science for dummies, in other words." "You?"
"Independent study," I say, chewing the sides of my cheeks. Ironically enough, my stellar grades in chemistry let me construct my own science course senior year. I suppose Simon would have been in AP Physics. I don't know what classes Addie and Cooper have with Mr. Avery, but in detention they acted surprised to see each other.
"So?" Nate asks.
"Well, they're friends, right? You'd think they'd have talked about it, or even been in the same class when it happened."
"Who knows? Could have been homeroom or study period for one of them. Avery's a jack of all trades," Nate says.
When I don't reply, he adds,
"What, you think those two masterminded the whole thing?"
"Just following a train of thought," I say. "I feel like the police are barely paying attention to how weird that phone situation is, because they're so sure we're all in it together. I mean, when you think about it, Mr. Avery knows better than anyone what classes we have with him. Maybe he did it. Planted phones in all our backpacks and coated the cups with peanut oil before we got there. He's a science teacher. He'd know how to do that." Even as I say it, though, the mental image of our frail, mousy teacher manically doctoring cups before detention doesn't ring true. Neither does Cooper making off with the school's EpiPens, or Addie hatching a murder scheme while watching the Food Network. But I don't really know any of them, including Nate, even though it feels like I do.
"Anything's possible," Nate says. "You pick a movie yet?"
I'm tempted to choose something cool and art-housey to impress him, except he'd probably see right through it. Plus, he picked a crap horror movie, so there's not a lot to live up to. "Have you seen Divergent?"
"No."
His tone is wary.
"And I don't want to."
"Tough," I didn't want to watch a bunch of people get killed by a mist created from an alien tear in the space-time continuum, but I did.
Damn it. Nate sounds resigned.
He pauses, then asks,
You have it buffered?
Yes. Hit play. And we do. Chapter 13.
Cooper. Friday, October 5th, 3:30 p.m. I pick Lucas up after school and stop by Nani's hospital room before our parents get there. She'd been asleep most of the time we visited all week, but today she's sitting up in bed with the TV remote in hand.
This television only gets 3 channels, she complains as Lucas and I hover in the doorway. We might as well be in 1985, and the food is terrible. Lucas, do you have any candy?
No, ma'am, Lucas says, flipping his too long hair out of his eyes. Nani turns a hopeful face to me, and I'm struck by how old she looks. I mean, sure, she's well into her 80s, but she's always had so much energy that I never really noticed. It hits me now that even though her doctor says she's recovering well, we'll be lucky to go a few years before something like this happens again. And then at some point, she's not going to be around at all.
I got nothing. Sorry, I say, dropping my head to hide my stinging eyes.
Nani lets out a theatrical sigh.
Well, goddamn. You boys are pretty, but not helpful from a practical standpoint.
She rummages on the side table next to her bed and finds a rumpled $20 bill.
Lucas, go downstairs to the gift shop and buy 3 Snickers bars, one for each of us. Keep the change and take your time.
Yes, ma'am.
Lucas's eyes gleam as he calculates his profit. He's out the door in a flash, and Nani settles back against a stack of hospital pillows.
Off he goes to pad his pockets. Bless his mercenary little heart, she says fondly.
Are you supposed to be eating candy right now? I ask.
Of course not, but I want to hear how you're doing, darling. Nobody tells me anything, but I hear things.
I lower myself into the side chair next to her bed, eyes on the floor. I don't trust myself to look at her yet. You should rest, Nani.
Cooper, this was the least dangerous heart attack in cardiac history. A blip on the monitor. Too much bacon, that's all. Catch me up on the Simon Kelleher situation. I promise you it will not cause a relapse.
I blink a few times and imagine myself getting ready to throw a slider, straightening my wrist, placing my fingers on the outer portion of the baseball, letting the ball roll off my thumb and index finger. It works. My eyes dry and my breathing evens out, and I can finally meet Nani's eyes. It's a goddamn mess. She sighs and pats my hand.
Oh, darling, of course it is.
I tell her everything. How Simon's rumors about us are all over school now, and how the police set up shop in the administrative offices today and interviewed everybody we know, plus lots of people we don't know. How Coach Ruffalo hasn't pulled me aside yet to ask whether I'm on the juice, but I'm sure he will soon. How we had a sub for astronomy because Mr. Avery was holed up in another room with 2 police officers. Whether he was being questioned like we'd been or giving some kind of evidence against us, I couldn't tell. Nani shakes her head when I finish. She can't set her hair here the way she does at home, and it bobs around like loose cotton.
I could not be sorrier you got pulled into this, Cooper. You of all people. It's not right.
I wait for her to ask me, but she doesn't. So I finally say, tentatively, because after spending days with lawyers, it feels wrong to state anything like an actual fact. I didn't do what they say, Nani. I didn't use steroids, and I didn't hurt Simon.
Well, for goodness sake, Cooper,
Nani brushes impatiently at her hospital blanket.
You don't have to tell me that.
I swallow hard. Somehow the fact that Nani accepts my word without question makes me feel guilty. The lawyer's costing a fortune, and she's not helping. Nothing's getting better.
Things will get worse before they get better,
Nani says placidly.
That's how it goes. And don't you worry about the cost. I'm paying for it.
A fresh wave of guilt hits me. Can you afford that?
Course I can. Your grandfather and I bought a lot of Apple stock in the 90s. Just because I didn't hand it all over to your father to buy a McMansion in this overpriced town doesn't mean I couldn't have. Now, tell me something I don't know.
I'm not sure what she means. I could mention how Jake is freezing out Addie and all our friends are joining in, but that's too depressing. Not much else to tell, Nani.
How's Keeley handling all this?
Like a vine. Clingy, I say before I can stop myself. Then I feel horrible. Keeley's been nothing but supportive, and it's not her fault that makes me feel suffocated.
Cooper.
Nani takes my hand in both of hers. They're small and light, threaded with thick blue veins.
Keeley is a beautiful, sweet girl. But if she's not who you love, she's just not. And that's fine.
My throat goes dry and I stare at the game show on the screen. Somebody's about to win a new washer-dryer set, and they're pretty happy about it. Nani doesn't say anything else, just keeps holding my hand.
I don't know what you mean, I say.
If Nani notices my good old boy accent coming and going, she doesn't mention it.
I mean, Cooper Clay, I've been in the room when that girl calls or texts you, and you always look like you're trying to escape. Then someone else calls and your face lights up like a Christmas tree. I don't know what's holding you back, darling, but I wish you'd stop letting it. It's not fair to you or to Keeley.
She squeezes my hand and releases it.
We don't have to talk about it now. In fact, could you please hunt down that brother of yours? It may not have been the best idea I ever had to let a 12-year-old wander the hospital with money burning a hole in his pocket.
Yeah, sure. She's letting me off the hook, and we both know it. I stand up and ease out of the room into a hallway crowded with nurses and brightly colored scrubs. Every one of them stops what they're doing and smiles at me.
You need help, hon?
The one closest to me asks. It's been that way my whole life. People see me and immediately think the best of me. Once they know me, they like me even more. If it ever came out that I'd actually done something to Simon, plenty of people would hate me. But there'd also be people who'd make excuses for me and say there must be more to my story than just getting accused of using steroids. The thing is, they'd be right.
Nate, Friday, October 5th, 11:30 p.m. My father's awake for a change when I get home Friday from a party at Amber's house. It was still going strong when I left, but I'd had enough. I've got ramen noodles on the stove and tossed some vegetables into Stan's cage. As usual, he just blinks at them like an ingrate.
You're home early,
my father says. He looks the same as ever, like hell. Bloated and wrinkled with a pasty yellow tinge to his skin. His hand shakes when he lifts his glass. A couple of months ago, I came home one night and he was barely breathing, so I called an ambulance. He spent a few days in the hospital, where doctors told him his liver was so damaged he could drop dead at any time. He nodded and acted like he gave a shit, then came home and cracked another bottle of Seagram's. I've been ignoring that ambulance bill for weeks. It's almost $1,000, thanks to our crap insurance, and now that I have zero income, there's even less chance we can pay it. I have things to do. I dump the noodles into a bowl and head for my room with them.
See my phone? My father calls after me. Kept ringing today, but I couldn't find it.
That's because it's not on the couch, I mutter, and shut my door behind me. He was probably hallucinating. His phone hasn't rung in months. I scarf down my noodles in 5 minutes, then settle back onto my pillows and put in my earbuds so I can call Bronwyn. It's my turn to pick a movie, thank God, but we're barely half an hour into Ringu when Bronwyn decides she's had enough. I can't watch this alone. It's too scary, she says.
You're not alone. I'm watching it with you.
Not with me. I need a person in the room for something like this. Let's watch something else instead. My turn to pick.
I'm not watching another goddamn Divergent movie, Bronwyn.
I wait a beat before adding,
you should come over and watch Ringu with me.
Climb out your window and drive here.
I say it like it's a joke, and it mostly is. Unless she says yes.
Bronwyn pauses, and I can tell she's thinking about it as a not joke. My window's a 15-foot drop to the ground, she says.
Joke.
So use a door. You've got like 10 of them in that house.
Joke.
My parents would kill me if they found out.
Not joke. Which means she's considering it.
I picture her sitting next to me in those little shorts she had on when I was at her house. Her leg pressed against mine, and my breathing gets shallow.
Why would they? I ask.
You said they can sleep through anything.
Not joke.
Come on, just for an hour till we finish the movie. You can meet my lizard. It takes a few seconds of silence for me to realize how that might be interpreted.
That's not a line. I have an actual lizard. A bearded dragon named Stan.
Bronwyn laughs so hard she almost chokes.
Oh my God. That would have been completely out of character, and yet, for a second, I really did think you meant something else.
I can't help laughing, too.
Hey, girl. You were into that smooth talk.
Admit it.
At least it's not an anaconda,
Bronwyn sputters. I laugh harder, but I'm still kind of turned on. Weird combination.
Come over, I say.
Not joke. I listen to her breathe for a while until she says,
I can't.
Okay. I'm not disappointed. I never really thought she would. But you need to pick a different movie. We agree on the last Bourne movie, and I'm watching it with my eyes half closed, listening to increasingly frequent texts from Amber chime in the background. She might be starting to think we're something we're not. I reach for that phone to shut it down when Bronwyn says,
Nate, your phone.
What?
Someone keeps texting you.
So?
So it's really late.
And? I ask, annoyed. I hadn't pegged Bronwyn as the possessive type, especially when all we ever do is talk on the phone, and she just turned down my joke-not-joke invitation.
It's not customers, is it?
I exhale and shut the other phone off.
No, I told you, I'm not doing that anymore. I'm not stupid. All right.
She sounds relieved, but tired. Her voice is starting to drag.
I might go to sleep now.
Okay. Do you want to hang up?
No.
She laughs thickly, already half asleep.
I'm running out of minutes, though. I just got a warning. I have half an hour left.
Those prepaid phones have hundreds of minutes on them,
and she's had it less than a week. I didn't realize we'd been talking that much. I'll give you another phone tomorrow. I tell her, before I remember tomorrow's Saturday and we don't have school. Bronwyn, wait. You need to hang up. I think she's already asleep until she mutters, "What?" Hang up, okay? So your minutes don't run out and I can call you tomorrow about getting you another phone. Oh, right. Okay. Good night, Nate. Good night. I hang up and place the two phones side by side, pick up the remote, and shut off the TV. Might as well go to sleep.
Chapter 14. Addie. Saturday, October 6th, 9:30 a.m. I'm at home with Ashton, and we're trying to figure out something to do. But we keep getting stuck on the fact that nothing interests me. Come on, Addie. I'm lying across an armchair, and Ashton nudges me with her foot from the couch. What would you normally do on a weekend? And don't say hang out with Jake, she adds quickly. But that is what I'd do, I whine. Pathetic. But I can't help it. I've had this awful, sickening lurch in my stomach all week, as though I'd been walking along a sturdy bridge and it vanished under my feet. Can you honestly not come up with a single non-Jake-related thing you like? I shift in my seat and consider the question. What did I do before Jake? I was 14 when we started dating, still partly a kid. My best friend was Rowan Flaherty, a girl I'd grown up with who moved to Texas later that year. We'd drifted apart in ninth grade, when she had zero interest in boys. But the summer before high school, we'd still ridden our bikes all over town together. I like riding my bike, I say uncertainly, even though I haven't been on one in years. Ashton claps her hands, as if I'm a reluctant toddler she's trying to get excited about a new activity. Let's do that! Ride bikes somewhere! Ugh, no. I don't want to move. I don't have the energy. I gave mine away years ago. It was half rusted under the porch, and you don't have one anyway. We'll use those rental bikes. What are they called? Hub bikes or something? They're all over town. Let's find some. I sigh. Ash, you can't babysit me forever. I appreciate you keeping me from falling apart all week, but you've got a life. You should get back to Charlie. Ashton doesn't answer right away. She goes into the kitchen, and I hear the refrigerator door opening and the faint clink of bottles. When she returns, she's holding a Corona and a San Pellegrino, which she hands to me. She ignores my raised eyebrows. It's not even 10 o'clock in the morning, and takes a long sip of beer as she sits down, crossing her legs beneath her. Charlie is happy as can be. I'm guessing he's moved his girlfriend in by now. What? I forget how tired I am and sit up straight. I caught them when I went home to get more clothes last weekend. It was all so horribly cliched. I even threw a vase at his head. Did you hit him? I ask hopefully. And hypocritically, I guess. After all, I'm the Charlie in my and Jake's relationship. She shakes her head and takes another gulp of her beer. Ash. I move from my armchair and sit next to her on the couch. She's not crying, but her eyes are shiny, and when I put my hand on her arm, she swallows hard. I'm so sorry. Why didn't you say something? You had enough to worry about. But it's your marriage. I can't help looking at Ashton and Charlie's wedding photo from 2 years ago, which sits next to my junior prom picture on our mantle. They were such a perfect couple. People used to joke that they looked as though they came with the frame. Ashton had been so happy that day, gorgeous and glowing and giddy, and relieved. I tried to squash the idea because I knew it was catty, but I couldn't help thinking Ashton had feared losing Charlie right up till the day she married him. He was tremendous on paper. Handsome, good family, headed to Stanford Law. and our mother had been thrilled. It wasn't until they'd been married a year that I noticed Ashton almost never laughed when Charlie was around. It's been over for a while, Addie. I should have left 6 months ago, but I was too much of a coward. I didn't want to be alone, I guess, or admit I'd failed. I'll find my own place eventually, but I'll be here for a while. She shoots me a wry look. All right, I've made my true confession. Now you tell me something. Why did you lie when Officer Budapest asked about being in the nurse's office the day Simon died? I let go of her arm. I didn't. Addie, come on. You started playing with your hair as soon as he brought it up. You always do that when you're nervous. Her tone's matter-of-fact, not accusing. I don't believe for 1 second you took those EpiPens, so what are you hiding? Tears prick my eyes. I am so tired, suddenly, of all the half-truths I've piled up over the past days and weeks, months, years. It's so stupid, Ash. Tell me. I didn't go for myself. I went to get Tylenol for Jake because he had a headache, and I didn't want to say so in front of you because I knew you'd give me that look. What look? You know. That whole, Addie, you're such a doormat look. I don't think that, Ashton says quietly. A fat tear rolls down my cheek, and she reaches over to brush it away. You should. I am. Not anymore, Ashton says. And that does it. I start flat out bawling, curled in the fetal position in a corner of the couch with Ashton's arms around me. I don't even know who or what I'm crying for. Jake? Simon? My friends? My mother? My sister? Myself? All of the above, I guess. When the tears finally stop, I'm raw and exhausted. My eyelids hot, and my shoulders sore from shaking for so long. But I feel lighter and cleaner, too. Like I've purged something that's been making me sick. Ashton gets me a pile of Kleenex and gives me a minute to wipe my eyes and blow my nose. When I finally wadded up all the damp tissues and tossed them into a corner wastebasket, she takes a small sip of her beer and wrinkles her nose. This doesn't taste as good as I thought it would. Come on, let's ride bikes. I can't say no to her now. So I trail after her to the park a half mile from our house, where there's a whole row of rental bikes. Ashton figures out the sign-up deal, swiping her credit card to release 2 bikes. We don't have helmets, but we're just going around the park, so it doesn't really matter. I haven't ridden a bike in years, but I guess it's true what they say. You don't forget how. After a wobbly start, we take off on the wide path through the park, and I have to admit, it's kind of fun. The breeze flutters through my hair as my legs pump and my heart rate accelerates. It's the first time in a week I haven't felt half dead. I'm surprised when Ashton stops and says, "Hour's up." She catches sight of my face and asks, "Should we rent for another hour?" I grin at her. "Yeah, okay." We get tired about halfway through, though, and return the bikes so we can go to a cafe and rehydrate. Ashton gets our drinks while I find seats, and I scroll through my messages while I wait for her. It takes a lot less time than it used to. I only have a couple from Cooper, asking if I'm going to Olivia's party tonight. Olivia and I have been friends since freshman year, but she hasn't spoken to me all week. "Pretty sure I'm not invited," I text. Only Girl trills out with Cooper's response. I make a mental note that when all this is over, and I have a minute to think straight, I'm going to change my text tone to something less annoying.
"That's BS. They're your friends, too."
"Sitting this one out," I write. "Have fun." At this point, I'm not even sad about being excluded. It's just one more thing. Cooper doesn't get it. I guess I should thank him. If he'd dropped me like everyone else, Vanessa would have gone nuclear on me by now. But she doesn't dare cross the homecoming king. even when he's been accused of steroid use. School opinion is split down the middle about whether he did it or not, but he's not saying either way. I wonder if I could have done the same. Bluffed and brazened my way through this whole nightmare without telling Jake the truth. Then I look at my sister, chuckling with a guy behind a coffee counter in a way she never did with Charlie, and remember how careful and contained I always had to be around Jake. If I was going to the party tonight, I'd have to wear something he picked out, stay as late as he wanted, and not talk to anyone who might make him mad. I miss him still. I do. But I don't miss that.
Bronwyn. Saturday, October 6th, 10:30 a.m. My feet fly over the familiar path as my arms and legs match the rhythm of the music blaring in my ears. My heart accelerates, and the fears that have been crowding my brain all week recede, replaced by pure physical effort. When I finish my run, I'm drained, but pumped full of endorphins, and feel almost cheerful as I head for the library to pick up Maeve. It's our usual Saturday morning routine, but I can't find her in any of her typical spots and have to text her. "Fourth floor," she replies, so I head for the children's room. She's sitting on a tiny chair near the window, tapping away at one of the computers. "Revisiting your childhood?" I ask, sinking to the floor beside her. "No," Maeve says, her eyes on the screen. She lowers her voice to almost a whisper. "I'm in the admin panel for about that." It takes a second for what she said to register, and when it does, my heart takes a panicky leap. "Maeve, what the hell? What are you doing?" Looking around, "Don't freak out," she adds with a sideways glance at me. "I'm not disturbing anything, but even if I were, nobody would know it's me. I'm at a public computer." "Using your library card?" I hiss. "You can't get online here without entering your account number." "No, using his." Maeve inclines her head toward a small boy a few tables over, with a stack of picture books in front of him. I stare at her incredulously, and she shrugs. "I didn't take it from him. He left it lying out, and I wrote down the numbers." The little boy's mother joins them then, smiling as she catches Maeve's eye. She'd never guess my sweet-faced sister just committed identity theft against her 6-year-old. I can't think of anything to say except, "Why?" "I wanted to see what the police are seeing," Maeve says. "If there were any other draft posts, other people who might have wanted to keep Simon quiet." I inch forward in spite of myself. "Were there?" "No, but there is something odd about Cooper's post. It's date-stamped days after everyone else's, for the night before Simon died. There's an earlier file with his name on it, but it's encrypted, and I can't open it." "So?" "I don't know, but it's different, which makes it interesting. I need to come back with a thumb drive and download it." I blink at her, trying to pinpoint the exact moment when she morphed into a hacker investigator. "There's something else. Simon's username for the site is AnarchySK. I googled it and came up with a bunch of 4chan threads he posted to, constantly. I didn't have time to read them, but we should." "Why?" I ask as she loops her backpack over her shoulder and gets to her feet. "Because something's weird about all this," Maeve says matter-of-factly, leading me out the door and down the stairs. "Don't you think?" "Understatement of the year," I mutter. I stop in the empty stairwell. So she does, too, half-turning with a questioning look. "Maeve, how'd you even get into Simon's admin panel? How did you know where to look?" A small smile tugs at the corners of her mouth. "You're not the only one who grabs confidential information off computers other people were using." I gape at her.
So Simon was posting about that at school and left it open? Of course not. Simon was smart. He did it here. Not sure if it was a one-time thing or if he posted from the library all the time, but I saw him one weekend last month when you were running. He didn't see me. I logged into the computer after him and got the address from the browser history. I didn't do anything with it at first, she says, meeting my incredulous look with a calm gaze. Just put it aside for future reference. I started trying to get in after you came back from the police station. Don't worry, she adds, patting me on the arm. Not from home. Nobody can trace it. Okay, but why the interest in the app, before Simon even died? What were you going to do? Maeve purses her lips thoughtfully. I hadn't figured that part out. I thought maybe I'd start wiping it clean right after he posted, or switch all the text to Russian, or dismantle the whole thing. I shift my feet and stumble a little, grabbing the railing for support. Maeve, is this because of what happened freshman year? No. Maeve's amber eyes get hard. Bronwyn, you're the one who still thinks about that, not me. I just wanted the stupid hold he had over the entire school to stop. And, well, she lets out a short, humorless laugh that echoes against the concrete walls of the stairwell. I guess it did. She starts back down the stairs with long strides and pushes hard on the exit when she gets to the bottom. I follow her silently, trying to wrap my brain around the fact that my sister was keeping a secret from me, similar to the one I kept from her, and that both of them tie back to Simon. Maeve gives me a sunny smile when we get outside, as if the conversation we just had never happened. Bayview Estates is on our way home. Should we pick up your forbidden technology? We could try. I've told Maeve all about Nate, who called this morning to say he'd leave a phone in the mailbox of 5 Bayview Estate Road. It's part of a new development of half-built houses, and the area tends to be deserted on weekends. I'm not sure how early Nate gets moving on a Saturday, though. We reach Bayview Estates in less than 15 minutes, turning into a street filled with boxy, half-finished houses. Maeve puts a hand on my arm as we approach number 5. Let me go, she says with a forbidding air, eyes darting around dramatically, as though the Bayview police could descend with sirens blaring at any minute. Just in case. Have at it, I mutter. We're probably too early anyway. It's barely 11. But Maeve returns, waving a small black device with a triumphant flourish, laughing when I yank it from her. Eager much, nerd? When I power it up, there's one message, and I open it to a picture of a yellow-brown lizard sitting placidly on a rock in the middle of a large cage. Actual lizard, reads the caption, and I laugh out loud. Oh, my God, Maeve mutters, peering over my shoulder. Private jokes. You're so into him, aren't you? I don't have to answer her. It's a rhetorical question.
Cooper. Saturday, October 6th, 9:20 p.m. By the time I get to Olivia's party, nearly everyone's out of it. Somebody's puking in the bushes as I push open the front door. I spot Keeley huddled next to the stairs with Olivia, having one of those intense conversations girls get into when they're wasted. A few juniors are toking up on the couch. Vanessa's in a corner trying to paw at Nate, who couldn't look less interested as he scans the room behind her. If Vanessa were a guy, somebody would have reported her by now for all the unsolicited groping she does. My eyes briefly meet Nate's, and we both look away without acknowledging each other. I finally find Jake on the patio with Luis, who's headed inside for more drinks. What do you want? Luis asks, clapping me on the shoulder. Whatever you're getting. I take a seat next to Jake, who's listing sideways in his chair.
What's up, killer? He slurs and sputters out a laugh. Are you getting tired of murder jokes yet? 'Cause I'm not. I'm surprised Jake is this drunk. He usually holds back during football season, but I guess his week's been almost as bad as mine. That's what I came to talk to him about, although as I watch him swat hazily at a bug, I'm not sure I should bother. I try anyway. How are you doing? Been a lousy few days, huh? Jake laughs again, but this time not as though he finds anything funny. That's so Cooper of you, man. Don't talk about your shit week, just check in on mine. You're a goddamn saint, Coop. You really are. The edge in his voice warns me I shouldn't take the bait, but I do. You mad at me for something, Jake? Why would I be? It's not like you're defending my whore ex-girlfriend to anybody who will listen. Oh, wait! That's exactly what you're doing. Jake narrows his eyes at me, and I realize I can't have the conversation I came to have. He's in no frame of mind to talk about easing up on Addie at school. Jake, I know Addie's in the wrong. Everybody knows it. She made a stupid mistake. Cheating isn't a mistake. It's a choice, Jake says furiously, and for a second he sounds stone-cold sober. He drops his empty beer bottle on the ground and cocks his head with an accusing glare. Where the hell is Luis? Hey! He grabs the arm of a passing sophomore and plucks an unopened beer out of his hand, twisting the cap off and taking a long sip. What was I saying? Oh, yeah, cheating. That's a choice, Coop. You know, my mom cheated on my dad when I was in junior high. Screwed up our whole family. Threw a grenade right in the middle and... He flings an arm, spilling half his beer, and makes a whoosh sound. Everything exploded. I didn't know that. I'd met Jake when I moved to Bayview in eighth grade, but we didn't start hanging out till high school. Sorry, man. That makes it even worse, huh? Jake shakes his head, eyes glittering. Addie has no clue what she's done. Ruined everything. But your dad forgave your mom, right? They're still together? It's a stupid question. I was at his house a month ago for a cookout before all this started. His dad was grilling hamburgers and his mom was talking to Addie and Keeley about a new manicure place that opened in Bayview Center. Like normal. Like always. Yeah, they're together. Nothing's the same, though. It's never been the same. Jake's staring in front of him with such disgust that I don't know what to say. I feel like a jerk for telling Addie she should come, and I'm glad she didn't listen to me. Luis returns and hands us both a beer. You going to Simon's tomorrow? He asks Jake. I think I can't possibly have heard Luis right, but Jake says, I guess. Luis catches my confused look. His mom asked a bunch of us to come over and, like, take something to remember him by before they pack his stuff. Creeps me out since I barely knew the guy, but she seems to think we were friends, so what can you say, right? He takes a sip of his beer and cocks an eyebrow at me. Guess you're not invited? Nope. I say, feeling a little sick. The last thing I want to do is pick through Simon's things in front of his grieving parents, but if all my friends are going, the slight's pretty clear. I'm under suspicion and not welcome. Simon. Man. Jake shakes his head solemnly. He was freaking brilliant. He holds his beer up, and for a second I think he's going to pour it onto the patio in a homeboy salute. But he refrains and drinks it instead. Olivia joins us, wrapping one arm around Luis's waist. Guess those two are back on again. She pokes me with her free hand and holds up her phone, her face bright with that excited look she gets when she's about to share a great piece of gossip.
Cooper, did you know you're in the Bayview Blade?
The way she says it, I'm pretty sure they're not covering baseball. This night keeps getting better.
Had no idea. Sunday edition, online tonight, all about Simon. They're not accusing you, exactly, but the four of you are named as persons of interest, and they mention that stuff Simon was going to post about you. There are pictures of you all, and, it's been shared a few hundred times already, so... Olivia hands me her phone. It's out there now, I guess.
Chapter 15.
Nate. Monday, October 8th, 2:50 p.m. I hear the rumors before I see the news vans. Three of them parked out front of the school with reporters and camera crews waiting for last bell to ring. They're not allowed on school property, but they're as close as they can get. Bayview High is loving this. Chad Posner finds me after last period to tell me people are practically lining up to be interviewed outside. They're asking about you, man, he warns. You might want to head out the back. They're not allowed in the parking lot, so you can cut through the woods on your bike. Thanks. I take off and scan the hallway for Bronwyn. We don't talk much at school to avoid, as she says in her lawyer voice, the appearance of collusion. But I'll bet this will freak her out. I spot her at her locker with Maeve and one of her friends, and sure enough she looks ready to throw up. When she sees me, she waves me closer, not even trying to pretend she hardly knows me. Did you hear? She asks, and I nod. I don't know what to do. A horrified realization crosses her face. I guess we have to drive past them, don't we? I'll drive, Maeve volunteers. You can, like, hide in the back or something. Or we can stay here till they leave, her friend suggests. Wait them out? I hate this, Bronwyn says. Maybe it's the wrong time to notice, but I like how her face floods with color whenever she feels strongly about something. It makes her look twice as alive as most people, and more distracting than she already does in a short dress and boots. Come with me, I say. I'm taking my bike out back to Bowdoin Street. I'll bring you to the mall. Maeve can pick you up later. Bronwyn brightens as Maeve says, That'll work. I'll come find you in half an hour at the food court. Are you sure that's a good idea? Mutters the other girl, giving me a hard look. If they catch you together, it'll be 10 times worse. They won't catch us, I say shortly. I'm not positive Bronwyn's on board, but she nods and tells Maeve she'll see her soon, meeting her friend's annoyed glance with a calm smile. I feel this stupid rush of triumph, like she chose me. Even though she basically chose not winding up on the 5 o'clock news. But she walks close to me as we head out the back door to the parking lot, not seeming to care about the stairs. At least they're the kind we've gotten used to. No microphones or cameras involved. I hand her my helmet and wait for her to settle herself on my bike and loop her arms around me. Too tight again, but I don't mind. Her death grip, along with how her legs look in that dress, is why I engineered this escape in the first place. Went out of the woods long before the narrow trail I'm taking widens into a dirt path that runs past a row of houses behind the school. I take back roads for a couple of miles until we make it to the mall, and ease my bike into a parking spot as far from the entrance as I can get. Bronwyn takes the helmet off and hands it to me. Squeezing my arm as she does. She swings her legs onto the pavement, her cheeks flushed and her hair tousled.
Thanks, Nate. That was nice of you.
I didn't do it to be nice. My hand reaches out and catches her around the waist, pulling her toward me. And then I stop, not sure what to do next. I'm off my game. If anyone had asked me 10 minutes ago, I would have said I don't have game. But now it occurs to me that I probably do, and it's not giving a shit. When I'm still sitting and she's standing, we're almost the same height. She's close enough for me to notice that her hair smells like green apples. I can't stop looking at her lips while I wait for her to back away. She doesn't. And when I raise my eyes to hers, it feels like the breath is yanked right out of my lungs. Two thoughts run through my head. One, I want to kiss her more than I want air. And two, if I do, I'm bound to screw everything up and she'll stop looking at me that way. A van screeches into the spot next to us and we both jump, bracing for the Channel 7 news camera crew. But it's an ordinary soccer mom van filled with screaming kids. When they tumble out, Bronwyn blinks and moves off to the side. "Now what?" she asks. "Now wait till they're gone and get back here." But she's already walking toward the entrance. "Buy me a giant pretzel for saving your ass," I say instead. She laughs, and I wonder if she's thankful for the interruption. We walk past the potted palms that frame the front entrance, and I pull the door open for a stressed-looking mother with two screaming toddlers and a double stroller. Bronwyn flashes her a sympathetic smile, but as soon as we're inside, it disappears, and she ducks her head. "Everyone's staring at me." "You were smart not to have your class picture taken. That photo in the Bayview Blade didn't even look like you." "Nobody's staring," I tell her, but it's not true. The girl folding sweaters at Abercrombie & Fitch widens her eyes and pulls out her phone when we pass by. "Even if they were, all you'd have to do is take your glasses off. Instant disguise." I'm kidding, but she pulls them off and reaches into her bag for a bright blue case she snaps them into.
"Good idea. Except I'm blind without them."
I've seen Bronwyn without glasses only once before, when they got knocked off by a volleyball in fifth grade gym class. It was the first time I'd noticed her eyes weren't blue like I always thought, but a clear, bright gray. "I'll guide you," I tell her. "That's a fountain. Don't walk into it." Bronwyn wants to go to the Apple store, where she squints at iPod Nanos for her sister. "Mae's starting to run now. She keeps borrowing mine and forgetting to charge it." "You know that's a rich girl problem nobody else cares about, right?" She grins, unoffended.
"I need to make a playlist to keep her motivated. Any recommendations?"
"I doubt we like the same music."
"Maeve and I have varied musical taste. You'd be surprised. Let me see your library."
I shrug and unlock my phone, and she scrolls through iTunes with an increasingly furrowed brow. "What is all this? Why don't I recognize anything?" Then she glances at me.
"You have variations on the canon?"
I take the phone from her and put it back in my pocket. I forgot I downloaded that. "I like your version better," I say, and her lips curve into a smile. We head for the food court, making small talk about stupid stuff like we're a couple of ordinary teenagers. Bronwyn insists on actually buying me a pretzel, although I have to help her since she can't see 2 feet in front of her face. We sit by the fountain to wait for Maeve, and Bronwyn leans across the table so she can meet my eyes.
"There's something I've been meaning to talk to you about."
I raise my brows, interested, until she says,
"I'm worried about the fact that you don't have a lawyer."
I swallow a hunk of pretzel and avoid her eyes. "Why?"
"Because this whole thing's starting to implode. My lawyer thinks the news coverage is going to go viral. She made me set all my social media accounts to private yesterday. You should do that too, by the way, if you have any. I couldn't find you anywhere. Not that I was stalking you, Just curious. She gives herself a little shake, like she's trying to get her thoughts back on track. Anyway, the pressure's on. And you're already on probation, so you need somebody good in your corner.
You're the obvious outlier and scapegoat. That's what she means. She's just too polite to say it. I push my chair away from the table and tip it backward on two legs. That's good news for you, right? If they focus on me?
No!
She's so loud, people at the next table look over and she lowers her voice.
No, it's awful. But I was thinking, have you heard of Until Proven?
What?
Until Proven. It's that pro bono legal group that started at California Western. Remember, they got that homeless guy who was convicted of murder released because of mishandled DNA evidence that led them to the real killer?
I'm not sure I'm hearing her correctly. Are you comparing me to a homeless guy on death row?
That's only one example of a high-profile case. They do other stuff, too. I thought it might be worth checking them out.
She and Officer Lopez would really get along. They're both positive you can fix any problem with the right support group. Sounds pointless.
Would you mind if I called them?
I return my chair to the floor with a bang, my temper rising. You can't run this like it's student council, Bronwyn.
And you can't just wait to be railroaded.
She puts her palms flat on the table and leans forward, eyes blazing. Jesus. She's a pain in my ass, and I can't remember why I wanted to kiss her so badly a few minutes ago. She'd probably turn it into a project. Mind your own business. It comes out harsher than I intended. But I mean it. I've made it through most of high school without Bronwyn Rojas running my life, and I don't need her to start now. She crosses her arms and glares at me.
I'm trying to help you.
That's when I realize Maeve is standing there, looking back and forth between us, like she's watching the world's least entertaining ping-pong game.
Is this a bad time?
She says. It's a great time, I say. Bronwyn stands abruptly, putting her glasses on and hiking her bag over her shoulder.
Thanks for the ride.
Her voice is as cold as mine. Whatever. I get up and head for the exit without answering, feeling a dangerous combination of pissed off and restless. I need a distraction, but never know what the hell to do with myself now that I'm out of the drug business. Maybe stopping was just delaying the inevitable. I'm almost outside when someone tugs on my jacket. When I turn, arms wrap around my neck, and the clean, bright scent of green apples drifts around me as Bronwyn kisses my cheek.
You're right,
she whispers, her breath warm in my ear.
I'm sorry. It's not my business. Don't be mad, okay? I can't get through this if you stop talking to me.
I'm not mad. I try to unfreeze so I can hug her back instead of standing there like a block of wood. But she's already gone, hurrying after her sister.
Addie, Tuesday, October 9th, 8:45 a.m. Somehow, Bronwyn and Nate managed to dodge the cameras. Cooper and I weren't as lucky. We were both on the 5 o'clock news on all the major San Diego channels. Cooper behind the wheel of his Jeep Wrangler. Me climbing into Ashton's car after I'd abandoned my brand new bike at school and sent her a panicked text begging for a ride. Channel 7 News ended up with a pretty clear shot of me, which they put side by side with an old picture of 8-year-old me at the Little Miss Southeast San Diego pageant, where, naturally, I was second runner-up. At least there aren't any vans when Ashton pulls up to drop me off at school the next day. Call me if you need a ride again, she says, and I give her a quick, stranglehold hug. I thought I'd be more comfortable